We often hear these days of the generation gap. Children don't understand their parents, and their parents don't understand children. As I look back on my childhood, it was a very happy period. And as I recall, I don't remember any of my friends talking about family clashes. We accepted the culture of our parents without any question, as we accepted the school system. We didn't think of trying to second-guess our teachers as to whether it was the right education. We had no idea that it was our function to change the world. We wanted to fit into it and lead a happy life in the culture in which we had grown up. I don't think I have a warped idea of this, though I will say that I was very lucky in my parents. My father was not an outgoing person. He was very intelligent, had a marvelous memory, but wasn't interested in the sort of things that a boy would be interested in. So he and I were not particularly companionable, but I always had the greatest respect for him. On the other hand, my mother was an extraordinary woman. She had an active mind, a great interest in everything going on in the world. She had a host of friends. She was active in club affairs, loved travel, loved the outdoors, gardening, and she instilled that in me. She had many of the characteristics of her father, who was an adventurous person and went across the plains in 1850 as a young man. Who sought the excitement of going to California looking for gold. I wouldn't say that all kids liked school at that time. I did. I always liked school at all levels. I went to primary school at Old Webster School, at the corner of McCubbin and Laurel, and then later to the Central High School. It's down where the police station is now at 10th and Cedar Streets. Both of those schools, by present standards, were horrible fire traps. They had open stairways made of wood. There was no fire protection, as I remember. The toilet room was in the basement, and dark, one little dangling electric light cord hanging over it, and it would be considered unsanitary by any present standards. It didn't strike us as any great hardship, but now a parent teachers association would be up in arms, as would the fire marshals, if they had to send their children to that kind of a school. We always walked to and from grade school, came home at noon in grade school and went back again for 2 hours in the afternoon. High school, we 9 times out of 10, we walked the 2.5 miles to school and many times walked home, but did sometimes in bad weather take the streetcar home. We lived within 2 blocks of the then colored district. The colored people in St. Paul at that time were self-respecting, orderly lot. Most of them worked for the railroads as waiters and Pullman conductors, Pullman porters. The influx of Southern Negroes came very much later. There was no vandalism at that time. None of us locked our houses as I can remember it. And I can't remember a robbery or a purse snatching or an assault on the streets when I was a child. In school, there was no disciplinary problem. As I recall it, the most extreme punishment was to send a boy out in the hall to sit in a chair for half an hour to get him out of the classroom. But nowadays, I hear from my daughter-in-law that discipline is a serious problem in the schools. By and large, the children got on very well, black and white. In any school I ever attended, there were always one or two blacks, and where we did not mix socially, there was no hard feeling and no oppression of them in any way I can remember. The children got on pretty well together. Occasionally, some bully would have to be taken down, and back behind the grade school in the alley, we'd prearrange a fight that might go on for half an hour, and the bully would go home badly beaten up in most instances, and that would end it, and there wouldn't be another fight of that sort for a year or two. Well, as I said, there was practically no vandalism. The only time the things got out of hand a little was on Halloween, and there there was some pushing over of fences and that sort of thing. I remember one incident when I was a youngster, perhaps 10 or 12 years old. We went out in the evening with Han Reifler, who lived down the street, rather tough kid whose father was a plasterer, and as I remember. And at that time there were some outhouses in that part of town, and there was an outhouse back of a house on Grotto Street, and under Han's guidance we went over and pushed it over. Han was a little too aggressive on it, and his foot slipped and he fell down the vault and was up to his waist in the honey. The rest of us got away, but the owner of the place came out and caught Han, and he was given rather a rough time. We certainly had a very pleasant social life in high school. There were about 30 of us, equally divided between boys and girls, but were the active leaders in the school, which numbered about 1,600 boys and girls, as I remember it. We were the ones that were in the school plays, the school operettas. The boys were active in athletics. We ran the school paper. And we had a dancing club. We used to meet on Saturday nights out on Prior Avenue in a little hall. We always had chaperones, it's true, in those days. But certainly we were a very circumspect bunch of youngsters. There was no cheek-to-cheek dancing, for example. Not a bit of it. On weekend evenings, we'd often gather at one of the girls' houses, and we'd stand around the piano and sing all the popular songs. We used to make fudge, and used to pull taffy, and sometimes, theoretically, accidentally, we would get some of that taffy in the girls' hair, and which caused great excitement. I wanted to be an athlete, of course, as all boys did, and I tried out in my freshman year for the football team at high school, but I was entirely too light and never made it. Some of my friends, the Kennedy boys, Jack Farrington, and some others, went to the St. Paul Academy, that then was housed in that little yellow brick building at the corner of Dale Street and Portland Avenue. There were only about 11 boys big enough in the school to play football. And on the eve of a football game they had with Hastings, one of the members of the team was sick. So they recruited me, fitted me out in a St. Paul Academy suit, and I played end. As I remember it, we got licked in the football game, but I did succeed in making a touchdown. At Central High School, they'd had a trick play. It worked this way. The crowds used to stand on the sidelines, not stay back in the bleachers, and the end would sneak over and mingle with the crowd just off the field. Then as the ball was passed, he'd step out in the field and they'd throw it to him and he'd run for a touchdown. I did that, but caught the ball, ran over the goal line all right, but the umpire knew that I was off the field when the play started and he ruled the touchdown out. I always have kidded the St. Paul Academy boys that having played on their team, that they never gave me the letter. I also ran track in Central High School, the mile run. I used to practice evenings running around that block, which is bounded by Milton Street, Goodrich, Fairmount, and, well, the next block west of Milton, Chatsworth, I guess it was. Evening after evening, I'd go around there and time myself because I knew just exactly how many laps to the mile. Well, I never was able to beat Lee Capser, who ran for Mechanic Arts High School in the meet we had every year. He'd always beat me out by a yard or two and walk glibly off the field while I was just as sick as could be to my stomach from trying to catch up with him. However, I did hold the record in the mile run at Central High School for a number of years. There was absolutely no drinking in high school at that time. Well, there was one exception. The football team went down to Faribault one Saturday, and a lot of us went along on the train. There were two boys, Sam Lawler and Leonidas Repke, who did go into a saloon down in Faribault, had a few beers, and at least pretended to be quite high. I don't think they were really tight, but they pretended they were, and it made quite a commotion. The girls particularly were very shocked. In fact, even when I was first in college, if a girl smelt liquor on a man's breath at a dance, she wouldn't dance with him. Hard liquor, we didn't know anything about. Neither did our families. Any of the families I knew have liquor in their own homes, except one German family who made their own wine. There were no cocktail parties in those days, and it wasn't until Prohibition, when people began making bathtub gin in their own homes, that the cocktail party and mixed drinking became popular. Women in those days were never seen in a cocktail bar. Along about junior year, I believe it was, in high school, Doug Brand, a good friend of mine, had been reading about how the early voyageurs used to travel from Lake Superior to the Mississippi by way of the Brule River, crossing over at the headwaters into Upper Lake St. Croix and down the St. Croix River to the Mississippi. We thought we'd do that, so we shipped a canoe up to where the Northern Pacific Railway crossed the Brule, right near where the present St. Paul colony is, and we paddled up the Brule River. It went all right the first day, but the second day it began to rain, and we got up in a muskeg area with tamarack trees all around, a real swamp. And that was where the river got down to only about 6 feet wide and wound around until you had to make about 3 miles to make 1 mile horizontally. Also, where that had been an old canoe route, no doubt. I don't believe anybody had been through that for 50 years because there were deadfalls across it, brush tangled across it, and one of us had to stand in the bow with a short axe and chop this brush away to get up it, so we could only make a half a mile, perhaps, in an hour. We couldn't get out on the ground because it was all swamp. It rained harder and harder. That night we tried to sleep in the canoe, But the rain was so hard that the water soaked up and got our blankets terribly wet. It was just a streak of daylight, and we decided we had to do something. We saw a little mound a short away from the river where a great big old pine stump had been burned out. We mucked over to it and threw a tarpaulin over the top of the stump and slept there in our wet clothes the rest of the night. In the morning, Doug got up and climbed an old snag that was near us, up about 40, 50 feet, where he could look over the country, and he saw we were only a mile or so from a little old farm that had a meadow running down to the river. Well, I think it took us several hours to make that at last mile because it was thicker and twistier than ever. But we finally did and walked up to a farmhouse and persuaded him to put our canoe on a flatbed wagon and haul us 2 miles over to Upper Lake St. Croix, and we went on down the St. Croix River. I think it took us 7 or 8 days to get down to Stillwater, and I think in the whole way we didn't see any other canoes or boats on the river until we got below Taylor's Falls. In those days there were still some logs being run on the river, particularly the upper river, down as above Nevers Dam. We certainly lived in an innocent age as I look back on it. Of course, it was the end of the Victorian era, which was a era where the morals of at least the all but the upper class of England were very strict. There was absolutely no petting, as I think I said before. We never thought of kissing a girl at the door when we took her home. I remember that I fell wildly in love, my first crush, on a girl named Frankie Seddon, who lived right down the block from us. She didn't take a shine to me at all because of the boy about 2 years older that lived out in Merriam Park that she was enamored of. But I thought she was wonderful. And one time she was in a little school play and did a dance, and her skirts went up above her knees. One of the boys was talking, made some remarks about what good-looking legs she had. That really shocked me, and I was just about ready to have a fight with him. That looks really funny in retrospect when we think of the girls now wearing hot pants. In our junior year, there was some gossip in the school that one girl, I can't remember her name, might not be a virgin. Frances Bush, who was then Frances Collar, whom I see once in a while, was out at our house last summer, and I mentioned this whole subject. She remembered what a commotion it made, but she said the girls had run the thing down, and they were certain that there was absolutely nothing to the story. Now, that is really remarkable compared to conditions now. Here there were probably 700 or 800 girls in that school, and if there had been very much monkey business going on, surely some of us who were active in the school life would have known something about it. Incidentally, the boys were just as pure. I didn't know any of the boys that played around. There may have been some, but I never heard of it. I always worked in the summers. I liked to work. I always have liked to work. When I was 13 years old, the first job I had was as an office boy, assistant office boy, in the Northern Pacific General Office, which was then down at the foot of Broadway, and where 4th Street intersected it. It was in the car accountant's office. And our job, or one of my jobs, was to file in a great big lot of cubby holes that filled one wall what they called the on-hand reports that were sent in by every station agent along the line, listing the numbers and the names of the railroad owning all the cars there were on sightings at that station. I could just see a lot of these country agents sitting up half the night working over an oil lamp, filling out these long forms. We were to file them by stations. And as I say, there was a whole wall, perhaps 50 feet long, through these various pockets, large pockets for large stations and small pockets for small ones. The office boy went on vacation for 2 weeks, and so I had to do all this filing and then looking up things that the men in the upper office wanted from these pockets. Had to do it all myself, and the work piled up on me. When the head office boy came back, I said, I just haven't been able to keep up with this work, though I've been working overtime some. Oh, he said, forget it. We'll put it all in the round file. So he took the whole bunch and chucked it in a wastebasket. That was quite a shock to me as to the standards of business conduct at that time. As I said, I was paid $30 a month. We were paid twice a month, $15 every 2 weeks. And it was paid $10 in a $10 gold piece, $5 in the $5 gold piece. The $10 piece was about the size of a dime, and the $5 piece much smaller and very much thinner. The next year, I guess I was 14 years old. I might have been 15. I went out to work on a fruit ranch. It was on the Snake River, about 6 miles below Lewiston, Idaho. It was in a canyon with great lava bluffs on either side, which made it very hot and an ideal place to raise prunes and cherries and peaches. I spent most of the time picking the peaches. I didn't like the job at all. For one thing, it was fearfully hot, dusty, grimy, and it was an awfully tough bunch working there, floating labor and some Indians. We all ate in the kitchen of a little farmhouse. I guess there were about 10 of us. And the bunkhouse they had for them was just full of bedbugs. I couldn't stand that and made a frame, oblong frame, and stretched gunny sacks across it to make a sort of a fixed hammock and slept on that outside because there was no rain. Then I'd go down at night and try to take a bath, but the water was so muddy it was almost like, it looked like chocolate, but it was cool and did get the sweat off me. I was too proud, having wanted that job, to quit, though I was often tempted to do it. I saved up a few dollars, and on the way home that year, stopped off at Yellowstone Park and took a trip on one of those four-horse coaches that went around the park in those days. That was really the way to see the park, because there were very few people there, and you had the whole thing to yourself, and it took about 4 days, as I recall it, stopping each night at a hotel, and one got to know pretty well the crowd one was with. I happened to be with a younger group, and we had a wonderful time. After that, I spent 2 summers out at White Salmon, Washington. At that time, there was a great rage for people in this part of the country buying land to put into apple orchards in Yakima and Hood River and White Salmon. My father, like a lot of other Northern Pacific officials, fell for this craze, and he bought 20 acres in White Salmon. It was covered with heavy timber. The first summer, I worked with one white foreman and 4 Japs clearing this land, which meant cutting down these huge fir trees, which, I think averaged 2.5 feet through, and stacking them up in great piles. I did that by driving a team using skids, rolled them up in piles, and then we burned them. In retrospect, it seems a crime, all the thousands of feet of lumber we destroyed. The second summer, I was still quite crazy about the idea of ranching. I had drawn a plan for a small three-room house. It's true it was only one board thickness, but I built that myself with a little help from our old Swedish maid Esther, who would climb up on the roof and help me shingle. So that house was finished, and Mother, who had been living up at an adjoining farmhouse, was able to move in the last of the summer, and my father came out there too. In spite of the hard work, I was still enthusiastic about a fruit ranch, as I always have loved the outdoors. One reason, I suppose, we came out here to Sunfish Lake many years ago. But wanting to be a farmer, when I finished Central High School, I decided to go to the Agricultural College at Minnesota, which I did the fall of 1910. I lived at home and commuted over there by streetcar, and it took about an hour to get there because one had to take the Grand Avenue car to Snelling, transfer to the Crosstown line, go over to Como Avenue, transfer again out to the Raymond Avenue, and then walk about three-quarters of a mile to the college and reverse the thing coming home. Some of my classes in basic science, like physics and chemistry, were on the main university campus, and I also used to take the streetcar over there. Very often, we would get off at the city line instead of going all the way in the streetcar, because as long as the trip was confined to St. Paul, we paid only 5 cents, 10 cents, if we went all the way. And being used to walking, as we all were in those days, it didn't seem any hardship, and it is worthwhile saving that amount of money. And speaking of walking, we not only did a lot of it of necessity, we even liked it. The result was that we would take Easter vacations the last 2 years in high school by taking walking trips. The first expedition, about six of us, started to walk to Mankato. The first night we got as far as Shakopee and stayed in an old hotel there. I slept in a double bed with Knox Reeves. That was when we really found an infestation of bed bugs. For some reason, they didn't bite me too badly, but they certainly chewed Knox. There was a woman's hatpin on the dresser, and Knox would get up and light the kerosene light and look in the bed and spear the bed bugs on this hatpin. And when it came morning, he showed me he had this six-inch hatpin practically filled with bugs. Well, the second day, we were going to walk to Belle Plaine, and then the third day to Shakopee. By the time we got to Belle Plaine, we had so many blisters on our feet that we took the train back home. The second walking trip, another chap and I started to walk to Chisauga City, 36 miles, and we were going to do it in 2 days, walking as far as Hugo or Forest Lake the first day. We took the streetcar out to East 7th Street and then took to the NP tracks. When we got up as far as Forest Lake, we were pretty tired, but this sense of bravado got on. We both talked to each other, let's go on further and further, and so we kept on walking, and along about 10:30 at night, terribly footsore, we got to Chisauga City. It wasn't anything open. The place was dark. We knew the old Dow's house where we had stayed some summers, and they had a bowling alley. So we went in there and found a door open and tried to sleep with the pads that cushioned the balls at the end of the alley to cover over us. Well, we didn't sleep much that night. The next morning we went to the general store and bought some canned goods and ate it, because there was no restaurant in town, and started to walk to Taylor's Falls. Well, we got the 2 miles to Lindstrom, and our feet were so blistered that we just couldn't go on, and took the car back to St. Paul. I enjoyed my year at the Agricultural College. In fact, I don't remember any school year that I didn't reasonably enjoy. But by the time the year was over, I had come to the conclusion that while I loved outdoor work and loved farming and fruit farming and so on, that it perhaps wasn't too easy a way to earn a living, because I'd seen a lot of hardship in the farming country in those days. Go back to the Agricultural College. I had one amusing experience. I took a course in dairy husbandry under old Andrew Boss, who was the dean of the dairying industry in those days. And one of the items in his course was judging dairy cattle. And at the end of the season, we had what corresponded to a spelling bee. That is, we all judged cattle, and then he rated us on how accurately he thought we had judged the good qualities of these cattle. I suppose the class had about 25 or 30 boys in it. But two of them were from the farms. They knew a lot about dairy cattle. The two city boys knew very little, didn't know the front end of a cow from the back. But we had listened to what old Andrew Boss told us. And when it came to judging, I came in first and the other city boys second. The other country boys had too many prejudices that they couldn't get rid of. I felt when I finished the year at agricultural, at the College of Agriculture, that I was still pretty young. I was about pretty near a year ahead of my class. And I decided I'd stay out of college a year and work. So my father arranged for me to get a summer job with the Northern Pacific Land Examining Party in western North Dakota. And later in eastern Montana. The Northern Pacific, when it was built through to the coast, was given by the government a land grant consisting of the odd numbered sections of land for 40 miles on each side of the railroad. Most of the good land had been sold off years earlier to colonizing companies who brought in farmers from Scandinavia and Germany. They bought the land from the railroad very cheap, $1, $1.50 an acre, and they were interested in doing that because they wanted to settle up the country, which would produce railroad traffic. The land that was left, even at that time, 1911, was mostly rough land. For instance, we started in the Badlands of North Dakota, where we saw some sections without a blade of grass on them, just these gumbo buttes. But there were some spots that were capable of a little irrigation, and there was some good grazing land. Most of this grazing land had been rented to ranchers for a pittance, and some the company had sold off. But a great deal of it still was in the hands of the railroad. The examining party consisted of the foreman, a horse wrangler, because we had traveled and moved with horses, a cook, an office man, 4 examiners. I was the office man, so-called, and his job was to take the maps that the examiners brought in each day and reduce them to larger scale maps and prepare the proper reports that went into the company. An examiner took usually one section a day. You worked from corner to corner. He'd leave off at a corner one day and go back at that corner, and then, riding a horse, and setting a compass and running those section lines, trying to pick up the stones or posts that were at the section corners, and then riding through it and making rough maps. He had a soil auger, and where there was any land that was capable of cultivation, he would take soil borings and record them. An examiner had two horses, and he rode them alternate days. Sometimes he'd ride off 15 miles before he'd get his place, he'd go to work. When the work got too far off, they'd move the camp another day. I enjoyed it very much and apparently did a good job because I stayed on until it froze up in about November. And then the man who was head of this department in the Northern Pacific, Mr. Trzezinski, who came out and checked us on our work, asked me if I'd come back the next spring, and I said I would. Meanwhile, I arranged to get a job on a surveying party for the Northern Pacific Railway. Again, Father helped me in that, which was surveying a new line from Tacoma to Tunnel Point Defiance and save a grade that went over the mountain. Most of our work was along the edge of Puget Sound near Steilacoom, where we lived in an old house, party of surveyors, and it was a disagreeable time of year, winter time, because it drizzled practically every day. I was an axeman, which meant I had to go ahead and where we were going through brush and axe out the so that the transit men could get a sight through to the next point he wanted to establish. Also, it meant waiting a lot in cold water, in the sound, and like lumbermen who drove the river, logs in the rivers. It cut off the circulation in your ankles, and like many of the loggers, I got a terrible case of boils, and that brings me to a rather amusing incident. They were so bad that I couldn't get my shoes on, and I went into the Northern Pacific Hospital in Tacoma. I was a youngster, of course, then about 19 years old, and there were a couple of interns there in the hospital that weren't much more than my age. One day they came and said, "Come on down the hall here to the operating room. We want to put on a show here you'll enjoy." They said there's a section hand that had been working over in the warmer country on the east side of the mountains in summer, and when the weather got cold, he didn't like it, and so he began saying, "Sick of the bell, sick of the bell." Well, he kept it up so much they sent him over to the hospital. They looked at him every up and down, couldn't find anything wrong with him, and finally suspected that he was just malingering. So they said, "Come on, see what we're going to do." Well, what they did was take him in this operating gown and put him on this table. They didn't strap him down, but they went down to the kitchen and got a lot of butcher knives and hatchets and all sorts of things and spread them out there and put them on the table. He said, "What are you going to do?" I was standing out in the door watching this. And he said, "You're sick of the bell. We're going to open up your bell. We're going to fix your bell." And he got more and more excited, and they were honing these big butcher knives. All of a sudden, he jumped up, ran down the hall, having this little half gown on, and down the street in a pouring rain. Well, they caught him a few blocks and brought him back and gave him his clothes, but he decided that he wasn't sick of the bell anymore, and they didn't see any more of him. It was an interesting winter. I enjoyed it. As I remembered, I got $75 a month. Well, in the spring, I went back to the land examining. I think it was about April, joined the party at Miles City. And this time I was a full-fledged examiner. Got $100 a month, which looked like pretty good pay at that time. And I was good enough, so the foreman gave me some of the toughest examining jobs on it, because I took it more conscientiously than some of the other examiners did. They were a rather nice bunch of fellows on this examining crew, and one fellow named Monteith, I still correspond with. He's a little older than I am, lives down in Houston, and I get a letter from him every few months. That friendship has gone on for many years. Oh, yes, there was one very interesting incident that summer, too. There was a man named Slade who was some distant nephew of the Slade family that married into the Hill family and was connected with the Great Northern Railway. This young Slade was from New York. And when he came out to the examining party, he was to be the office man, which I'd been the year before, and he was for about a week he lasted. Well, being an Easterner, of course, he was gullible, and we filled him up with all kind of stories. Now, there were rattlesnakes around. We would see them certain places, usually on top of rocky buttes, but not out in the sagebrush where we usually camp. But we filled him up with the stories and got him pretty nervous. And one night, we were all sleeping outdoors in sleeping bags under the stars. One of the chaps took a lariat and coiled it up and put it in between his blanket and the bedroll, and then carried the end of it over to his bedroll. Well, it was bright moonlight, and this other fellow woke up in the night and yelled, "Slade, Slade, there's a rattlesnake right on your bedroll. Don't move. Don't move, and perhaps he'll crawl out." Then he began gradually pulling on this rope so it unwound around, and Slade could feel it squirming on his chest, you see, and was just frightened to death. Well, after he got the thing all out, then he gave him a good laugh. Well, as I remember it, Slade stayed about 3 or 4 days and decided he liked New York City better, and that was the end of Slade. I saw another thing that summer. But I'd love to have had a motion picture of, because it would have made a wonderful film. I was sitting eating my lunch on top of what we call a scoria butte. That's where the clay had been baked sort of red by the combustion of some of that lignite coal that had caught fire underneath through the ages. And as I sat there, I heard a rattlesnake rattle. Well, that wasn't very unusual. I didn't pay too much attention until all of a sudden I saw a big bull snake. It was about half again as big as the rattlesnake, and it was only, the head was poised only about 18 inches from the head of the rattlesnake. The rattlesnake making a great stir, his old tail going, and he was hissing. Well, I watched to see what had happened, and I think I watched for 5 minutes before there was any motion. Finally, the bull snake made thrust at him so quick you couldn't follow it with your eye, but he grabbed that rattlesnake right around behind his head so he couldn't get his fangs into him, and then wrapped around him. A bull snake, it seems, is a constrictor, like a boa constrictor. And he just strangled that snake by wrapping around him. That would have made a wonderful nature picture, I'm sure. But while I enjoyed all this outdoor work, I did want to go back to college. And some months before, I'd applied to Yale. I decided to apply to Sheffield Scientific School, which had what they call a select course, which was really an academic course in 3 years. I thought I'd rather take that 3-year course and go in with a freshman, as a freshman, so I would know my classmates from the beginning rather than try to transfer into the academic course as a sophomore. The select course was essentially an academic course with a little more emphasis on science, but you carried 5 hours of work a semester instead of 4 hours, which was in academics. So you got in pretty much the same work as you would in a 4-year academic course. Oh, yes, and to get into Yale, they said that I needed some more language. Well, I'd had a little French. I never liked languages particularly well, but having had only 1 year of French, they said I should have another and take the College Entrance Board examination for French. So I boned up on French, read a lot of French books and grammars and so on. I'd taken a few lessons when I was home for a month or two in the winter between those jobs. And so I went up to Helena, Montana, and took the College Board entrance examination, I think it was in June of that year, in French. And I passed it and was admitted to Yale. I thoroughly enjoyed Yale. One thing that made it especially nice for me was that I went in with a year's college credit, having quite a little English and science, so it let me pick my courses pretty well through that 3 years in Sheffield Scientific School. As a matter of fact, whether it was the second semester of the freshman year or the beginning of sophomore year, I had decided that I might be interested in medicine. Bill Norris, my friend who still keep up an acquaintance with and we visit back and forth. Bill Norris lives in Beverly Hills. I became well acquainted with. He was preparing for medicine. He got me interested in medicine. I used to go over to the New Haven Hospital with him sometimes on Sunday morning, and we'd get up in the gallery and watch surgical operations. So I began to prepare for medicine and took all of the sciences you'd think of. Of course, I'd had botany